Christian et al., Stephen K.S. Chung for appellant, and James H. Ashford and Amanda M. Jones for appellee. Argument on the merits.
Morning, counsel.
Morning.
Counsel, ready to proceed?
We are. All
right. Please do so.
Morning, Chief Judge. Please report. My name is Stephen Chung. I am counsel for the defendant appellant cross appellee LWC4 Corporation. This is the Eastern Garden Restaurant, and its owners Lawrence Chan and Linda Chan, whom I will refer to collectively as the Chans. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I've raised a number of points in my briefs, and I submit that they're all worthy of merit and your attention, but I intend to focus my oral argument on what I believe to be the ultimate issue in this appeal and the reason that oral argument was scheduled, which is whether public policy precludes an award of attorney's fees and costs to a party who successfully defends against a claim of unfair competition that is brought under Chapter 480 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. I believe that that is the ultimate issue that we are here to discuss this morning, and I will proceed. The facts underlying this case, which resulted in a final judgment from which this appeal was taken, were that the Chans were the tenants of Cam Center Shopping Center, the landlord. They operated a restaurant pursuant to a commercial lease. And the restaurant was not doing well, so they engaged a real estate broker, John Kobayashi, to assist them in selling the lease or renegotiating the rent with their landlord. The real estate broker breached his fiduciary duties. He brought in a new tenant, Starbucks, directly to the landlord and received a finder's fee commission, which he divided with the broker for Starbucks, about $15,000. That's in the judgment that was awarded in favor of Cam Center. And having breached his fiduciary duties, and the landlord had a new tenant, my client was in default of the rent. The landlord terminated the rent, filed a summary possession action, which was litigated, and my client lost. The landlord was awarded some $270,000 in damages and another $70,000 in attorney's fees for all the efforts involved in the summary possession action, including an unsuccessful counterclaim, which I had raised. So the landlord had already received $337,000 in damages, costs, and attorney's fees. And this case went up on appeal because I had attempted to raise a claim for unfair competition under Chapter 480-2E, which was adopted by the legislature in 2002. And the lower court denied my motion. The Supreme Court, however, reversed and found that I should have been allowed to bring that claim for unfair competition based on what we had alleged the broker to have done, breaching his fiduciary duties, and the landlord enticing the broker to breach his fiduciary duties by luring him with a real estate commission, a finder's fee. So we went back down to the trial court, and I was granted leave to file an amended counterclaim against the landlord, which raised that specific claim for unfair competition under 480-2E, nothing else. We alleged that we were a tenant, that we were attempting to sell our lease, that the real estate broker was induced to breach his fiduciary duties, the landlord encouraged that, took advantage of that, got a new tenant, terminated us. We did not bring any claims for breach of the landlord's obligations under the lease. Our claim was strictly in tort under 480-2E. Unfortunately, we did not prevail, and the landlord sought an award of costs and attorney's fees. We argued that costs and attorney's fees should not have been awarded because we brought our claim under the statute 480-13, which allows attorney's fees and costs only to a successful plaintiff and says nothing about making such awards to a successful defendant. Nevertheless, the lower court granted the landlord's request for costs and attorney's fees amounting to about $132,000 in attorney's fees.
So your argument is that based on public policy, anytime a plaintiff brings a 480 claim and loses, the other side can never, regardless of how the but the allegations of the 480 claim are, can never recover attorney's fees.
That's our position, Your Honor. We submit that it's a one-way street. The statute only provides as a remedy the award of attorney's fees and costs to a successful plaintiff who brings a private attorney general action. The statute, Chapter 480, was enacted because the legislature found that there was a need to level the playing field for businesses. And the legislature specifically said it's unlawful to engage in unfair methods of competition. And because the state has limited resources, the legislature wanted to encourage private litigants to bring private attorney general actions to make sure that businesses compete fairly by providing for an award of attorney's fees and costs as a remedy to a successful plaintiff.
Mr. Chung, what if a contract specifically said prevailing party, any claim arising out of the relationship between these parties leads to litigation, prevailing party shall be entitled to attorney's fees irrespective of whether you call it a 480-2 claim or any claim under 480. What if there's actual contract language that says that? What would be your...
We would submit, Judge Ginoza, that that contract provision would be contrary to public policy and would be unenforceable under such cases as Gonzales versus Nissan Motors, where the supervisor promises the employee that he's not going to be terminated, notwithstanding the claim of sexual harassment, and he is terminated. And he says, well, you promised that I wouldn't be terminated. And the court says, well, that's contrary to the intent of these laws that prohibit unlawful discrimination. And to uphold that contract would be contrary to public policy.
Under federal law, which 480 basically is a model of the federal law, are there cases that address that issue particularly?
We haven't found any case at on point other than that California case, Walker versus Countrywide Mortgages or Countrywide Homes, which we cited. But we believe that the intent of these statutes is to provide an incentive to plaintiffs only, that if the legislature, whether it's federal or state, intended to allow attorney's fees to be awarded to a prevailing party, they would have said so. We cited the Supreme Court case that discussed that civil rights statute, but there is actually a Hawaii statute, 607-25, that allows a prevailing party to be awarded attorney's fees, including a defendant. But as we point out in the Supreme Court case that we cited, the attorney's fees are not awarded in any case in which a defendant prevails. Even
but the statute doesn't say, notwithstanding any law to the contrary, a defendant in a 480 claim cannot receive attorney's fees. It just says plaintiff gets it.
That's right. And it's
so, but what about if there's an, the appellees are claiming that under another statute, they're within another statute, and based upon that statute, the legislature has enunciated a public policy that they should be able to collect attorney's fees in that situation. So how do you reconcile the competing, I mean, your argument in public policy is based upon a statute. What if they have a statute that specifically authorizes recovery of attorney's fees?
The other statute, 607.14, does authorize an award of attorney's fees in the sunset cases and does recognize that when you've got fee-shifting provisions, such as we have in this case, that that's okay. There's nothing per se unlawful about a fee-shifting provision, but where it's utilized in such a manner that it will be contrary to another expressed, explicit public policy. That expressed, explicit public policy, i.e. unlawful competition is against the law, should not be upheld. The attorney's fees should not be awarded in that
circumstance. Is it possible for a claim that's brought pursuant to 480 be in the nature of a subset?
I would submit not. I thought long and hard about that issue. I think that had you wished to bring a claim for a breach of contract, you would have brought a claim for breach of contract.
What about a 480 claim arising out of a contract?
That it was a tortious breach of contract?
No. In other words, is it possible to obtain attorney's fees based on a 480-dash claim under the assumption statute? 607-14, because there's two components, right? In the nature of a subset and an action on a contract.
I would submit that you could have a situation where both a assumptive type claims as well as 480-dash claims are raised and that you'd have to apportion, but I would submit that. I would submit that where the claim is strictly a tort claim under 480 for unlawful practices, that is not an assumptive claim.
Well, if that's the case, then we don't have to get to the public policy because either it's going to be covered under 607-14 or not. Right? You're saying basically you can't have both. It can never be both. It can't be a 480 claim and also covered by 607-14. So when would public policy ever come into play? Either we decide the 607-14 issue and yes or no, and then that decides the case.
Not if the award under 607-14 violates another express specific public policy. 607-14 is a broad statute that just says we will allow attorney's fees in assumptive actions. It's just a broad policy. It's similar to the Butler case that the Camp Center cites, Butler, that Colorado case, I believe, where the plaintiff, or the tenant of a landlord, was being sued for eviction and brought a counterclaim alleging that the landlord engaged in some unlawful practice and lost, and the landlord was awarded attorney's fees, and the tenant appealed and argued that it would be contrary to the public policy of allowing tenants access to the courts to award attorney's fees to a prevailing landlord. And the appellate court says, no, where you have a specific attorney general type statute that is designed to prevent some misconduct, you may have an argument, but here this is just a broad general statute, and it doesn't fall within that kind of category. But returning to my argument, we submit that the cases such as Gonzales, the Inland Boat case, the cases which discuss the common law of Hawaii and of the country, Inland Boat refers to the U.S. Supreme Court case, another union case, quoting that the courts do not hesitate to strike down contractual provisions which are contrary to explicit public policy. Here we have explicit public policy, a law that says unfair methods of competition are unlawful. Where you have such an explicit public policy, that has to be given precedent over any contractual provision.
But the only thing that statute actually says is that a prevailing party bringing an unfair competition claim gets attorney's fees. It doesn't say that it's against public policy for a prevailing defendant who has contractually agreed with another party that if they're sued in litigation arising out of their contract and win, that they can collect attorney's fees. You're asking us to infer from the structure of that statute that that's what the legislature intended.
That's correct. By specifically providing a prevailing plaintiff may be awarded as a remedy. It's a remedy. The attorney's fees and costs are a remedy, as the Supreme Court discussed in the Sierra versus the Tisha Query Realty case. I mean, it's a remedy that is designed to encourage these private attorney general actions to be brought by plaintiffs. So by expressly limiting the award, the remedy to the plaintiffs, and excluding any reference to defendants, the legislature signaled its intent that it is to be awarded only to prevailing plaintiffs and not to defendants.
Can I shift you a bit to another issue? What is your argument as to why, under the terms of the lease agreement, that this litigation doesn't arise out of the tenant's occupancy of the premises?
The first part of the litigation did. The summary possession action that Camp Center brought and the counterclaims that we brought initially, which we lost, those were brought under the lease and fell within that provision of the lease. And Camp Center was awarded $337,000 in damages, costs, and attorney's fees. The unfair competition claim that we brought, certainly it related to the relationship between Camp Center and my client, which resulted from the lease, but like the situation in the TSA case, it's merely the circumstance that brought the parties together, and the litigants were not suing to enforce the lease. In this case, we were not suing to enforce.
So you interpret arising out of as meaning that it has to be pertaining to a breach of the lease agreement?
you know, I'll be candid with the court. You know, I think that it's ambiguous, and I think that an argument can be made that anything that generates litigation in which the landlord is brought in would be covered under that phrase. But because that phrase is drafted by the landlord, it ought to be construed against the landlord and limited to circumstances that arise from the lease.
Well, I guess my question is, what's the purpose of that provision? Because in addition to that clause that we're talking about, there are also provisions that say if the tenant's in default and the landlord has to bring suit, then the landlord can recover. So the other part of that provision seems to address breaches of the lease. What does this arising out of the occupants of the premises cover or intend to cover?
I would agree that to the extent that the landlord has made a party to litigation as a result of some conduct of tenants, such as some patron comes into the restaurant and is injured somehow and brings an action against the restaurant as well as the landlord, perhaps for a spoil on the parking lot or something like that, and the landlord brought in perhaps under those circumstances, that provision would kick in. But those circumstances are okay so long as they don't violate a public policy. And the public policy in this case is to prevent unfair competition, which we allege the landlord violated.
Mr. Chung, the 337 somewhat thousand judgment awarded to CAM Center, that included the attorney's fees for the summary possession breach of contract action that was brought by CAM Center?
That is correct, and we're not appealing that.
Okay, and just out of curiosity, I mean, what was the amount, if you can recall generally, of the attorney's fees part of that?
Approximately $75,000.
Okay, thank you.
It was, I believe.
Now, does the fact that the complaint, the amended complaint, or amended counterclaim, alleges that one of the aspects of the competition between, that was unfairly engaged in, was who would, whether the existing tenant, your client, would remain in the premises or a new tenant would be placed into the premises. Does that make it arising out of the occupancy of the premises?
The allegation was strictly that you utilized our real estate broker, you caused him to breach his fiduciary duty in an improper manner, and we were damaged as a result of that.
Right, but one of the allegations as to the competition is with respect to the subject premises, the sellers intended to continue operating a restaurant if sellers could not sell the lease while the lessor wanted to terminate the lease and or require the premises in order to be able to lease the premises to a new investor. So that's one of your allegations as why the two parties were in competition.
That's right. They
so the competition involved occupancy of the premises.
Occupancy of the premises.
Does that mean that the litigation arises out of the occupancy of the premises?
Well, certainly the litigation arose from the occupancy of the premises.
All right, so you would concede then that it did fall within the terms of the lease agreement?
That's where I disagree, Your Honor. It was not an action brought to enforce any of the lease provisions, but not an action that arose out of any of the lease provisions other than perhaps occupancy. But we were perfectly willing to continue to operate and to pay double the rent and to make the landlord whole, which we intended to do. But unbeknownst to us, our broker had brought into the landlord this new tenant that the landlord accepted and kicked us out. If you don't have further questions, I'd like to reserve my time for rebuttal, but I would be happy to answer them.
My other question is, and also your argument is, any contract has to be construed according to the statutes in existence.
That's correct.
And essentially, you're arguing that this contract could not have been interpreted or intended to be inconsistent with Chapter 480.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. I have nothing further at this time, reserving my time for rebuttal.
Chief Judge Nakamura, Judge Foley, Judge Ginoza, good morning. With all due respect to Mr. Chung, the issue that is presented in this appeal is whether the trial court abused its discretion in awarding attorney's fees to CAM Center under HRS 607-14. I could use my entire time here this morning trying to convince the court that what I'm holding in my hand is a Ferrari. But I think by the end of the argument, I think it's a safe bet. No one in this room would think that you could get into this and drive off. The point being that no matter how I characterize this object in my hand, everyone in the room knows that this is a pen. The law works in a similar way. When the court is asked to determine whether attorney's fees should be awarded under 607-14, the court needs to look at the essential character of the action, not just at what the plaintiff has called it. And to determine the essential character of the action, the analysis is to look at the issues and the facts raised in the complaint, the substance of the entire pleading, the nature of the grievance, and the relief sought, not the formal pleadings. It is undisputed that that is the analysis that the Hawaii Supreme Court applies to determinations under 607-14. And this is an analysis that the Hawaii Supreme Court has followed for these determinations since at least 1984, when the court decided Schulz versus Hansenor. In understanding how that analytical framework works, it's helpful to look at the history of the assumpsit statute. The Hawaii legislature originally enacted the predecessor to 607-14 in the 1870s. And the original language in that statute was that attorney's fees could be taxed against the losing party in all actions of assumpsit. Now, when Hawaii adopted the modern civil procedure rules, it was a little difficult to apply that statute. And to fix that problem and to make it more consistent with the modern pleading requirements, the Hawaii legislature in 1972 amended 607-14 to provide that attorney's fees could be taxed against the losing party in all actions in the nature of assumpsit. And the Hawaii Supreme Court has recognized that what that change meant was that now the courts were required to make the determination about what is the essential character of the action. It's not just what the plaintiff specifically pled. Because no longer are we in a situation where where precise legal theories needed to be pled, as under the old pleading rules.
Well, counsel, if I may, the amended counterclaim filed by the defendants, how do you suggest that that is an action for the recovery of damages for the non-performance of a contract? The non-performance of a contract is one of the key criteria standards by which we look at whether an action is in the nature of a assumpsit. So again, how is the amended counterclaim that was filed by the defendants an action for the recovery of damages for a non-performance of a contract?
The assumpsit, that's part of what assumpsit means, but the Hawaii Supreme Court has also defined it a little broader. But that's in essence what it is. And here what you have, if you look at the Chan's counterclaim, the entire relationship between CAM Center and the Chan was a landlord-tenant relationship, a relationship governed by the rights and obligations set forth in the lease. In fact, that's the way the counterclaim characterizes the parties and describes the parties based upon their status in that contractual relationship.
But doesn't in the nature of assumption require an allegation of the breach of the underlying contract? And in this case, there's no allegation in the amended counterclaim of any breach of the lease agreement.
Requires a specific allegation of a breach of a contract. It requires an analysis of the character of the action. And here, if you look at what the Chans were alleging, they were alleging that they should have had a right to remain in the leased premises, that it was wrong for CAM Center to have terminated the lease. Clearly, that's where all of the Chans' damages flowed from, their alleged damages from the termination of the lease. So what they were saying was, CAM Center should not have terminated the lease. Well, the only right that the Chans had to be in the leased space was set forth in the lease. And the only obligation that CAM Center had to allow the Chans to be in the leased premises was set forth in the lease. And so, whether the termination was wrongful is necessarily rooted in the rights and obligations set forth in the lease. You can't divorce the two. They're entirely linked. So what the Chans were really alleging, clearly they tried to couch it in a different way, was that CAM Center didn't comply with the lease obligations, or at least with its implied obligations under the lease, to allow the Chans to remain in the space. That's clear that that's what the dispute is about in this case.
Were they alleging a violation of Chapter 480?
They certainly couched their complaint in that way.
And that's what they had to prove, and if they had to prove, they would prevail. Under 480, isn't that how their claim was being evaluated, whether they proved the elements under 480?
Certainly they could not have prevailed if they couldn't establish all of the elements under Chapter 480.
Isn't that why they didn't prevail? Isn't that what they were trying to prevail on, 480?
They tried to bring a Chapter 480 claim. That's the way they tried to characterize their complaint. Ultimately, they lost because they were not able to prove damages, which, regardless of whether you call it a Chapter 480 claim or a breach of contract claim, that's a problem.
Now, going back to the 607-14 statute, the first part of it is all actions in the nature of a sumset. But then there's a second part of it, which is in all actions on a promissory note or other contract in writing. So how do those two clauses differ? In other words, how does an action in the nature of a sumset differ from an action on a contract?
Two things. The second prong talks about an action on a contract in which the parties agreed to have attorney's fees. The nature of a sumset is broader. And if you look at, I believe it's the Larson versus Paysetter Systems case, the Hawaii Supreme Court defines a sumset, and it defines it broader than just a breach of contract. And in fact, there's a case of this court, Hong versus Kong, in which the court found that a restitution type of a claim was actually in the nature of a sumset. So a sumset does not mean breach of contract. It's a broader idea.
But is that how you read the first clause, the second clause? In other words, if it's an action on a contract, does that mean that before you can get attorney's fees under 607-14, it has to be an action for breach of that contract?
I don't think the statute provides that. It doesn't specifically say that there needs to be a breach of the contract.
Right, so I'm asking you, and in all actions, in all on a promissory note or other contract in writing, so if you parse the terms, all actions on a other contract. So what if it's an action on a contract, does that require an allegation that the contract's breached for it to fall within that the second clause of 607-14?
I don't think so. The statute doesn't say that. But the statute.
So what does the statute mean then, if it doesn't mean that?
The statute says that you need to look at the contract and see if it's a contract that provides for an attorney's fee. And so, in fact, you could limit your contract to specific types of situations in which attorney's fees would be available. But again, you need to go to the contract if, in fact, you're seeking attorney's fees under that second prong of 607-14.
I mean, counsel, isn't it true that you can have all manner of claims that are brought, some that would fall within the assumption statute, some that wouldn't? Why isn't this case similar to TSA, where there was an underlying contractual relationship which created the reason why the parties had to interact, which led to the claims which ultimately were litigated? So the underlying relationship was a contractual one, commercial one, and yet the alleged wrongdoing was not non-performance of the contract, it was other conduct. Why isn't this case, in terms of the amended counterclaim, because you folks have already gotten attorney's fees for your breach of contract claim, right?
Right.
So your clients have recovered some measure of attorney's fees, I take it under the assumption statute or the contractual language of the lease. But as to the amended counterclaim, why isn't this case like TSA?
In TSA, there were some underlying agreements mm-hmm. between the parties. But if you look at the court's analysis in that case, the court did not focus on how did the plaintiff characterize the specific claims. The court was really looking at what is the nature of the allegations. And in that case, in that analytical framework, the court focused on the fact that what the plaintiff was really alleging was that the defendant had fraudulently induced the plaintiff to enter into the agreement, and that the defendant had failed to disclose information to the plaintiff, which the plaintiff contended was a breach of the fiduciary duty that was implied by law because they were partners. So, in fact, the damages that the plaintiff were seeking did not flow from any frustrated expectations under the contract between the parties, but rather from these alleged wrongs, which are recognized by law.
So in your brief, you folks focused a lot on that in terms of the damages that the defendants were seeking. Lost profits was a large measure of it, as well as the damages that were, or the judgment that was awarded to your client in this very litigation. So speak to that. How does that fit into the analysis that you're talking about now?
One of the elements in this analysis that the Hawaii Supreme Court has followed since Schultz versus Hansover that I mentioned is that you should look at the relief that is sought by the plaintiff as an element of this analysis to determine the essential character of the action. And if you look at Larson versus Paysetter system, the Hawaii court case, when the court was doing the analysis there, it looked at what are the types of damages that the plaintiffs were seeking, and it asked itself, are these the type of damages that would flow from the frustrated expectations under our contract? And in that case, they weren't. They were more tort-type damages, personal injury types of things. So in these cases, you can see there is always a focus. The Hawaii Supreme Court does, as an important component of the analysis of whether an action is in the nature of a sumsit, to look at what the plaintiffs are seeking, what they're alleging, and what's really going on here. What are they trying to accomplish?
So your point is, no matter how far away from the actual contract, for instance, having to pay fees and costs in this case, as part of the earlier judgment in this case that's not on appeal, that somehow flows from the lease agreement.
Well, what they're alleging in their counterclaim clearly was that the damages that they were seeking flowed from the termination. That's clear from the counterclaim itself, which says the termination caused the Chan's damages. And it's also very clear from the interrogatory responses that the Chan's gave us, in which we asked them to define what their damages that they were alleging in this amended counterclaim. They identified the three elements. And when you look at each element, every element of their damages flowed directly from the termination of the lease. And the lost profits is a really clear example. What the Chans were claiming was that if they had been allowed to continue operating in the space, they were going to open this new restaurant, and they contended they were going to make $345,000 up until the point that the lease provision would have ended.
The argument on their side, or the allegations that were litigated with regards to the amended counterclaim, dealt with Mr. Kobayashi's failure to maintain his loyalty to the defendants, right? In terms of somehow potential new tenant, or what the Chans were looking for, a buyer for their lease, right? But somehow a potential new tenant was found to replace them. that it was a competition for a new lessee of that space. Is that an accurate articulation of what you understand the claims as to be under the amended counterclaim?
The Chans, in their effort to try to couch this as a Chapter 480 claim, use this unfair and this competition language. Okay. Mr. Chung said earlier that their broker swooped in and, unbeknownst to the Chans, found Starbucks and brought them in. In fact, the record actually shows that Linda Chan was clearly aware of Starbucks' interest, and she herself was interested in pursuing Starbucks. Okay. So I digress a little bit, but to get back to your question, they've tried to couch it as there being some kind of competition. In fact, there could not have been any competition between the landlord and the tenant for the space. If the Chans wanted to stay in the space, all they had to do was to comply with the lease, to pay the rent. And they admit that they weren't paying the rent. Camp Center could not have terminated the lease and could not have evicted the Chans if the Chans had continued to operate the restaurant and had paid their rent.
How long was the period of time between when they were in default and when the lease ultimately was terminated?
The Chan stopped paying rent in November of 2002. Then they closed the restaurant at the beginning of 2003. And so during 2003, it's established in the record that Cam Center told the Chan's broker on many occasions that if they did not pay the rent, that the landlord was going to file a summary possession action. And that ultimately happened. And I believe it was August of 2003.
Can I ask you a question on the public policy issue? Would it be proper, or could the landlord in this case have written into the lease agreement, and if you bring a 480 claim and we prevail, you must pay our attorney's fees?
I don't think that there would be anything unlawful or against public policy. Mr. Chung made...
So doesn't that sort of obviate, wouldn't that enable anyone involved in a contract to effectively obviate the provision of 480 that only permits a plaintiff who's a prevailing party to recover attorney's fees? And in other words, why have that statute if anybody in a contractual relationship can include in the contract, if you bring a 480-dash claim and we prevail, we get our attorney's fees?
Well, if the bringing the Chapter 480 claim prevails, then they would get attorney's fees under Chapter 480.
No. The landlord saying, if you bring a 480 claim against us and we prevail, you must pay our attorney's fees, even though we couldn't get those attorney's fees under 480.
Well, what we're talking now about is, and what you're, the scenario that you've presented is an unmeritorious claim that was asserted under Chapter 480. So there's a policy to encourage people, and Chapter 480 does provide incentives for parties already. It's built in for parties to bring Chapter 480 claims because they get attorney's fees that are uncapped except by reasonableness, and there's treble damages that are available. Okay, so there's a policy to bring meritorious, unfair and deceptive trade practices and unfair competition claims. But there's no policy that says you can bring unmeritorious claims and then obviate any sort of contractual agreements that you have made to provide for fee shift. Attorney's fee provisions and contracts are regularly enforced, and they do in fact serve important policy goals because they encourage parties to make some good considerations about the types of claims that they're bringing. The trial courts, always appellate courts, are busy. They have lots of cases in front of them. And it would better serve the public and justice for the courts to have meritorious claims, to be able to focus on the real issues in these cases, rather than to be bogged down with claims claims that people are bringing, the danger with reversing this case is you're setting the bright line rule that the Chans have asked this court to set here. And that is, no matter what my claim really is, no matter if I'm truly asserting a breach of contract claim, all I need to do to avoid a fee-shifting provision that I have agreed to in my contract is to call my breach of contract claim something that it's not, to call it a Chapter 480 claim. And I wipe everything that I've agreed to out. That's dangerous, because you're going to have these bizarre claims that are awkward. They're clearly breach of contract claims, but they're sort of, you know, a square peg shoved into a round hole. And the courts are going to have to be forced to deal with this.
In this case, was there ever a determination by the trial court that the allegation of unfair practice or competition was unmeritorious?
The rulings that enabled Chem Center to prevail were not based on a determination of whether or not.
It was on damages, right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
I would note, though, that I think the record, when you look at the record in this case, which spans many years due to the fact that there was an appeal, demonstrates that, in fact, Chem Center did not act unfairly.
It's just that there hasn't been a ruling. I mean, that there clearly has not been any determination one way or another in this case as to the unfair competition question on the merits, not as to damages, but as to the actions of your client.
That's correct.
Okay.
If I could leave with a couple of guiding principles. If the court is struggling to determine whether or not this is in the nature of a sunset, I would leave you with these two guiding principles from the Hawaii Supreme Court. The first is that it's well established that when there is doubt about whether an action is in the nature of a sumpsuit or tort, the presumption is that the suit is in a sumpsuit. Second, the trial court judge in this case was really in the best position to evaluate the nature of the claims. Judge Hefo presided over this case since 2004 through several motions before this case went up on appeal the first time, and then again on remand through several motions, and ultimately resulting in presiding over a trial between the Chans and their broker. She did all of this before awarding Chem Center its attorney's fees and costs in this case. So she understood the nature of the grievance between the parties and what the Chans were alleging. The standard of review for determinations about whether a party is entitled to attorney's fees and whether the attorney's fees were reasonable reflects the fact that the trial court really is in the best position to make that determination.
But doesn't the standard review on abuse of discretion also have a component, an error as a matter of law, if the lower court makes an error as a matter of law?
Yes.
And we can look at the same record that the lower court is looking at and make a judgment whether or not the error is a matter of law.
Yes, it does have that component. But what I would submit is that the analysis here is what is the essential character of the action. And as a result, the trial court is really in the best position to have evaluated that. And so I would simply submit that if it's a close call, the trial court cannot be found to have abused
its discretion. We're not talking credibility or weight, are we? Credibility, weight of the evidence, that's not before us, right? I mean, isn't that generally what we defer? You know, we don't second guess when it comes to credibility of the witness. We give some deference in terms of the court weighing. None of that's involved, is it?
It's not an issue of credibility, but when you look at the analysis for determining the essential character of the action for purposes 607-14. It's a really holistic approach, and it's based upon an understanding of the nature of the grievance between the parties. So,
but there's nothing that the lower court judge saw that we don't see, is that true, based on the record?
The court is familiar with the parties, saw the parties, in fact, through a trial. So it understands, I think, what was really going on here in a way that is a little broader than perhaps the record reflects. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. The jury found that the broker breached this fiduciary duty. Unfortunately, we could not prove damages resulting from that breach. I'd like to focus on the assumption argument for a bit. If we were to change the facts of our case and assume that there were an option to extend this lease, and the landlord had said to the Chan, not only do I not like Chinese food, I don't like Chinese, and I'm not going to extend that lease under that option under any circumstance. Does that make this, and an action were brought for discrimination, does that turn this into an assumptive case? I submit that it does not. I submit that it does not turn it into an assumptive case any more than this claim for unfair competition turns this case into an assumptive case.
What's the line, though? I mean, it is. There's a contract underlying this whole relationship.
Certainly.
What principle would you say controls the case so that you're on this side of the principle and other cases would be on the other side?
The same principle as in TSA. Sure, you have the relationship because there is a contractual a lease agreement, which is a contract. That's why you have the relationship. But the actions that you take don't necessarily arise under the contract or constitute a breach of that contract. If you discriminate unfairly or unlawfully, or if you breach some fiduciary duties of your partner, as in the TSA case, or if you engage in unlawful competition that the legislature said is inappropriate, those are torts that are separate from breaches of contract or separate from actions arising under the contract.
What Ms. Jones argues, though, is that with regards to TSA, the damages that were sought didn't flow from a breach of the contract. As opposed to her argument is here, the damages that were specifically sought by your client all basically circled back to the contract. How would you address that?
Would those damages be any different from the discrimination case hypothetical that I presented? I would submit not. That if the lease is not extended because of a discriminatory unlawful purpose, the damages that that plaintiff in that case would be seeking would be identical. So that doesn't transform the case into an assumption case or a breach of contract case because the damages are similar. It's just one element to look at.
So separate and apart from the assumption issue, okay, I mean, whether there's a breach of contract and seeking damages for the non-performance of the lease is one issue, but you have a lease provision here that was specifically entered into by your client. And the language is what it is, fairly broad language. The argument that I hear is simply public policy, you have Chapter 480, and therefore, if you have a claim brought under 480, you can always, the argument that they're making is you can just write that out of the contract.
And I submit that is the correct interpretation, that certainly, a fee-shifting provision or a provision such as that would not per se be unlawful. But if its application would violate some expressed public policy, it becomes contrary to that public policy and therefore becomes unenforceable, such as the promise in the Gonzalez case that you don't have to worry about your employment even though you are guilty of sex discrimination.
Should it matter if you are successful in your claim?
I don't believe it should matter because if the legislature had intended for prevailing defendants to be awarded attorney's fees and costs, they would have said so just by saying a prevailing party, as in 607-25. But by expressly excluding successful defendants, the legislature signaled its intent to only allow plaintiffs to recover as a remedy, costs and attorney's fees. If the court has further questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them. Otherwise, I'll just summarize here. I will submit that awarding costs and attorney's fees to a successful defendant in a Chapter 4E case will not only negate the intent of the statute, but it will also chill private attorney general actions, especially where businesses like Camp Center have written agreements with attorney's fees provisions like the one in this case. Upholding the award to Camp Center will encourage other businesses to include similar attorney fee provisions in their contract. That would be contrary, I think, to public policy to allow businesses, larger businesses, to insert these kinds of provisions into their contract and to chill actions by aggrieved plaintiffs who may not have the same bargaining power to be afraid to bring actions against their landlord for fear of having to be in a situation like my clients find themselves where they sued based upon their reasonable belief that a violation of the law occurred and lost the case. And now, in addition to paying all the damages and attorney's fees for the breach of the lease, find themselves facing another bill of another $137,000 for their unfair competition case. That cannot be the law, I submit. Thank you.
We take the case under advisement.
All rise.